The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
I'll be sharing this Teisho with David Roshi, so I'll try not to take too big a piece. Gateless Gate, Case 23, Wainong, neither good nor evil. The sixth ancestor was pursued by Ming, the head monk, as far as Dayu Peak. The teacher, seeing Ming coming, laid the robe and bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the Dharma. There should be no fighting over it. You may take it back with you." Ming tried to lift it up, but it was as immovable as a mountain. Shivering and trembling, he said, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, lay brother, please open the way for me." The teacher said, "Don't think good. Don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming the head monk?" In that instant, Ming had great satori. Sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made his bow, saying, "Beside these secret words and secret meanings, is there anything of further significance?" The teacher said, "What I have just conveyed to you is not secret. If you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you." Ming said, "Though I practice at Wang Mei with the assembly, I could not truly realize my original face. Now, thanks to your pointed instruction, I'm like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it is cold or warm. Lay brother, you are now my teacher." The teacher said, "If you can say that, then let us both call Wang Mei our teacher. Maintain your realization carefully." And the verse. "It can't be described. It can't be pictured. It can't be praised enough. Stop groping for it. The original face has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed." So as we sit together on the occasion of Rohatsu, we are invited to identify with all those in our past who have realized, fully realized their nature, who have manifested their original face. And this is one of many stories that we have in our koan collection, in our koan curriculum, that record such a moment. And it's a particularly rich and important story for us, partly because it concerns the sixth ancestor, Wainong, who was the last of our ancestors to be the ancestor of all living Zen teachers. Every Zen school that has survived descends from Wainong. And Wainong had a lot to do with establishing Zen as we understand it now. And as we practice it now. Wainong is an interesting figure, and there's a lot of backstory to this koan. I'll just touch on a few points. And one of them is that Wainong came from an impoverished family. His father was some kind of minor official who lost his employment and then died young. And that left Wainong to fend for himself and his mother. And he would go out and collect wood and chop wood and bring it to town to sell. He was seen, according to legend at least, and I'm going to stop saying according to legend at least, because everything I'm about to say is according to legend. He was seen as an illiterate, as an unlettered peasant. And yet, one day in the marketplace, he heard a monk reciting part of the Diamond Sutra. And what he heard penetrated him completely and turned him around, changed the way he thought of himself, changed the way he thought of the world, changed the way he conceived the relation between them. This Kensho experience, not reserved for intellectuals, for the highly born, but open to anyone, including this unlettered woodcutter from the south of China, which was seen as a backwater at the time. And so Wei Nong had this great opening. And he had the wisdom to know that he needed to find a teacher who could help him understand what had happened to him, who could help him more fully realize this great realization, who could help him integrate it into his life. And so he eventually found his way to the assembly of the fifth ancestor, Hongren. And he impressed Hongren sufficiently that Hongren invited him to stay, but didn't ordain him, didn't have him sit in the Dharma hall practicing Zazen and listening to Taishos and chanting sutras with the other monks, but put him in the kitchen areas, the outbuildings, and set him, or had the Tenzo set him to polishing rice, to taking the hulls off rice with a millstone perhaps, or a large mortar and pestle, or both. And so there he sat, and this was his practice, grinding away, doing his work, doing his labor, but doing it in the same spirit that we do our Zazen practice, deepening his understanding, not becoming impatient, not thinking he should be anywhere else. Quite an example for us. And at some point, some months later, Hongren, the fifth ancestor, realized that he was getting closer to death and he needed to name a successor. And so he announced that there would be a kind of a contest where the monks were invited to write a gatha, a four-line verse, expressing their understanding of the Dharma, expressing their Dharma. And none of the monks felt that they were up to this, except for the one who was seen as the likely successor. And that was not Wei Nong, of course, who was there grinding away, de-hulling rice, but that was Shen Xiu. And Shen Xiu wrote a gatha, which I won't recite to you, but you know, it was about practice, keeping the mirror of the mind free of dust. And all the monks were deeply impressed. Someone recited it in Wei Nong's hearing, and he saw that it was not the whole story, that there was something missing in Shen Xiu's understanding. And so he came up with a different gatha. And the force of this gatha was in his expression of prajna, of nothing really needed to do, nothing to attain, no dust to clear away. And this was written, because supposedly he was illiterate, this was written up for him near the other verse, and Hongren saw the wisdom of it, but also saw the problem. This was an institution already, Zen Chan, Chinese form of Zen, becoming institutionalized, hierarchies, jealousies, and he saw that Wei Nong would not be accepted, this unlettered peasant from the south, that the other monks would not tolerate this, and so he rubbed out the lines and went to Wei Nong privately and transmitted to him the robe and the bowl of Bodhidharma from five generations before. Quite something to have. I assume that they were not in the best shape, but what a symbol of Wei Nong's attainment, Wei Nong's understanding. When I say attainment, of course, nothing to attain. And Hongren, knowing that the other monks might go so far as to kill Wei Nong, rode him across the river and said, go off on your own and let your understanding ripen further. Don't start teaching yet. And so Wei Nong headed for the mountains, and some of the monks caught wind of this and followed him. And they all dropped away except one who was quite burly and athletic and had been a general, apparently, Ming, the head monk. And Ming finally caught him, caught Wei Nong, kind of like treeing a raccoon, treed him on a mountaintop. And then our story begins. And quite interesting how Wei Nong responds to being caught up with, to this fierce ex-military guy, catching up to him, ready to seize the robe and the bowl, and who knows what else he has on his mind. I imagine him breathless. Ming, he's just run up a mountain. I imagine him a little bit frightened of what he's about to do. And Wei Nong practices ahimsa, no harm, turns to him and says, we're not going to fight over this. We don't fight over the Dharma. Just if you really need this, you can take it. And as you know from the koan, Ming tries to lift it up the bowl, the robe and the bowl, and he can't. What does that mean? Does that mean that some miracle was happening, that Wei Nong had developed miraculous powers? No. It tells us everything we need to know about where Ming was at that moment, how Ming's heart was opening. And his body racing ahead of his mind. This often happens to us, right? Our body's wisdom often precedes our realization that there's something we should or shouldn't be doing. We learn in our Zen practice to listen to our guts, to listen to our hearts. And Ming's body won't do what he thinks he wants and helps him realize that that's not what he wants to do at all. And what he really wants is the Dharma. What he really wants is realization. And he tells that. He suddenly accepts this lay person, who he calls lay brother, as a teacher. He sees Wei Nong's attainment simply in the way that Wei Nong is interacting with him. Quite a beautiful moment in the story. And then Wei Nong begins to teach him. And first he says, don't think good, don't think evil. Centuries and centuries and centuries of non-dualistic teaching coming together in just those two phrases. Let go of all these oppositions, including, right, implicitly lay and ordained and peasant and highborn and intellectual and illiterate, and who's right here and who's wrong here. Shito, a couple of generations later, will say, let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk innocent. And this is the invitation to Ming, to help Ming enter into a space where he can really hear the next bit of teaching. What is the original face of Ming, the head monk? And this might be thought of as the kernel of this koan, the koan within the koan. It goes on to become a koan in its own right, often phrased as, what is your original face before your parents were born, or show me your original face before your parents were born. And this original face just bounces through the whole tradition to this day. Taego Bowu, for example, one of our Korean ancestors, says, the original face, who is it? As soon as it is mentioned, the arrow sinks in stone. And in this koan, as soon as it's mentioned, the arrow sinks in stone. Ming has some realization. Again, his body runs ahead of his mind. He sweats. He trembles. Quite beautiful. This whole body response by this very physical monk, this big guy, this big scary guy who now is kind of a puddle of sweat and tears. The invitation to us at this point is to ask, what is my original face? Before I was born, before even my parents were born, what is my original face? Each of us needs to take this to heart. Each of us needs to be Ming at this moment. Each of us needs to let go of our preconceptions about right and wrong and good and evil and on, and open up to this amazing invitation. And with this, I'll ask David Roshi to pick up the thread.
So faced with the impossible, a monk Ming, you and me, what is your face before your parents were born, makes no sense, might send us off in all kinds of different directions. We might try to analyze it. We might try to read through other texts to see what we can find. What a strange invitation to go beyond good and evil, to go beyond this and that, to go beyond has and has not. How do we let go of have and have not? Because most of us are quite sure that we do not have what we need. This conviction of lack, this a great certainty of lack, appears to be quite common in us human beings. How do we meet this? How do we go beyond this certainty? And I think first, of course, is to begin to see it. We hear these teachings again and again, already Buddha, already awake. What did the Buddha realize when the morning star came up? That I and all beings already awake. Already awake. And Hui Neng, the illiterate peasant, had this great awakening. as he heard some verse being chanted. And we can hear that and wish for ourselves. I wish I had had that. I wish that I could have that. And the invitation in these stories is to somehow leap beyond have and have not, to enter into Wei Nung, the sixth ancestor. He is not some figure from ancient history. In fact, a historical record of him is quite meager. He is a figment of our imagination. We might say he is a part of us. And here he is appearing in this Sishin so many centuries later. So each one of us is not just Ming, the monk. I love Alan's description of this burly, athletic, fearsome person. That burly, athletic person is you. Slightly scary. Aren't we all slightly scary? We have all been climbing the mountain. We have all come here to climb the mountain, to pursue the ancestors. And this great intention of Monk Ming, this great desire, born out of his delusion. Ming is clearly the most deluded person in this story, and each one of us clearly deeply deluded. And Ming does not get rid of his delusion. He doesn't say to himself, well, I know I'm already Buddha and that's good enough. No, he persists in his delusion. He is the most deluded and climbs the mountain with great energy because he knows that something wrong has happened and he is going to get the robe and the bowl. So all of us, to some degree or another, think we're going to get something. Again, from this sense of lack, we can hear a sense of lack, not really true, I'm already Buddha, and we can collapse. I say, well, yeah, I guess I should know and I don't. But to use what we have, in Zen we are encouraged to use available materials. Maybe you should be a little smarter than you are. Maybe you should be a little less anxious than you are. Maybe you should be 10,000 things, but you're not, are you? You are the only one. This great problem that you have, the problem of yourself, I'm too quarrelsome, I'm not strong enough, I hide too much, I come forward too much, all of these opinions, these are not the problem. This is not an exercise in getting rid of anything. One of the things I love about the story of the Buddha under the Bo tree is that one, his conviction, born a prince and with all kinds of luxury and a good, powerful life ahead of him, he leaves it all because he wanted to know for himself. He tried all kinds of different techniques and was quite adept. Several masters invited him to stay in their school, but he was not satisfied. And eventually he sat down under the Bodhi tree and vowed not to move until he saw into this great matter of life and death. And so he sat down, we all sit down under the Bodhi tree. Each time the bell rings, sitting under the Bodhi tree, having made our vow, this infinite vow, the infinity of 25 minutes, the infinity of one breath. Life is not something that happens on a timeline that we can plot on the wall, but life only happens here. There is no other life, there is no other time, and we, along with the Buddha, sit down under the Bodhi tree and vow not to move, vow to look into this, to find out, through looking into our own experience. As the Buddha sat through the night, I guess if I was writing the story, I might write in the story of, and he became more and more peaceful, and life was sweet, and he had a lovely, calm night, and the morning star came, and he got it. But the Buddha's night was not calm and peaceful. He was assailed by the forces of Mara. He was assailed by the demons of his of the world, the demons of temptation and desire, the demons of anger and fear. He sat just like you and I do, with wandering mind, with all kinds of problems. He did not proceed jhana through jhana to exalted states, but was there in the middle of his life, in the middle of the problem of himself. And it is said not that he defeated the armies of Mara. There was no pitched battle. And in fact, throughout Buddha's life, in the stories of him, Mara, the difficulty of life, is one of his companions. He has conversations with Mara, his dear, dear troubled, dear broken self. But on the night of that we are celebrating, the night of his awakening, the morning of his awakening with the morning star, he sees into Mara. He sees into the true nature of this greed, anger, and ignorance. He sees that everything that arises is just arising, and the nature of everything is light and illumination. And as we go into what seems to be the problem, as we refuse to be who we think we should be, we can see that this energy of life, this energy of life that appears so beautifully, so perfectly as you and me, the snow that falls off and on this morning, the sensations in the body, this is all the beating heart of the Buddha. And so the delusion is not what we are trying to get rid of, but we see that delusion and awakening are like light and dark, coming and going. We might think we would be better off if we were different, and we hope we will be different, but when we get down to it, we can't. The Buddha could not be different. He could not erase himself. And in his failure, and in Monk Ming's failure to lift up the robe and the bowl, He'd run so far, he'd come so far, so strong, so dedicated, and there he is. He cannot do it. And you, my friend, cannot do it. This is not a thing that can be done. This is not a thing that can be contained had in any kind of personal way. But as we trust and follow, as we come back again and again, as we look more and more deeply into the real nature of the universe, we can begin to see, and maybe just very, very slowly, maybe in bits, big bits, little bits, doesn't matter. We can see that it is not any outward manifestation. It is not any inward experience that is required or in some way even possible. This original face, as in the verse later on, as is said, where could it hide? In the longing, in the certainty of lack, in the delight, everywhere, everywhere shines, everything shines, you already shining, and here us telling stories long into the morning, stories of mountains and robes and bowls and impossible questions, all of this part of it, and all of it right here, the morning star has indeed risen. Thank you. So please sit comfortably and let's make our little oval, and Anne and Ray, if you can come in a little bit here. Yeah, and Jamie, push back, Jamie and Madhu.
Dave, maybe come a little closer to Laura, and Will can come a little closer to you.
So, the time to look into this together. From your questions, concerns, delights, and complaints. Lara?
As I was like listening to the story, that Ming is the one that runs after. Yeah. I was really just thinking how much I admired like Ming going after something, just like so, just pouring sweat and effort into like, I want this, I'm gonna go get it. And I kind of, I guess, separated myself a bit from Ming, thinking, oh, I guess I don't really do that, you know? Like sometimes I play like a little like, well, cool, I don't need that robe or that bowl, like I don't really want it, and maybe a protection of myself. Just if I don't want it, you know, then I won't get let down, or I won't look like Ming trying to lift it, but and not being able to. But I also just felt so tender towards Ming in that. And then I also, I mean, I guess as I'm even sitting here now, I feel like I can join with Ming because I am tired and I am here, but I just watched that like admiring and separating, and then all of a sudden like realizing like, oh my gosh, no, that's, you know, here I am right now, my leg hurts, and you know, I could probably take a nap. so yeah. I guess I did have a question in it, is like, it, you know, we talk about greed and stuff, like, is that, like, it just doesn't seem like there was like greed of him wanting to take the robe and the bowl, like, you know, like it, I don't look at it like that. It doesn't seem like a poison to me, but is it?
Yeah, so your identification with Ming is going pretty far here. and yeah, of course there's greed in running out. I mean, he doesn't trust his teacher, Hongren. He knows better. He's going to grab this valuable artifact that goes back to Bodhidharma. I'm not going to go so far as you and say, no, he's just been a really good guy. But you know what? I love the way that you built up to this, which is to talk about his exhaustion and your exhaustion. And exhaustion is not a problem in Zen. You know, sometimes we need to just wear ourselves out. We need to get to that point where we can't even lift up a piece of cloth and then see what happens. So so congratulations, Laura, for exhausting yourself on our behalf. Not just grateful to you, but happy for you.
And you know, the don't think good, don't think evil thing, it applies here. But not in the sense of everything is one and there's no good and there's no evil, but really seeing each thing for what it is. And we do that with greed. We make it. We put it into the evil category. It's, you know, that's a tradition in traditional Buddhism, but not in Zen. Greed is a powerful, powerful thing that transforms. The gesture of greed, grabbing something, is the gesture of giving. Eventually, it doesn't physically transform. It just emotionally, mentally transforms. This is the great teaching that there is nothing that is a problem as long as we can be open to it and then let it guide us into bigger, more awakened moments. And yeah, I mean, just to add on to what Alan is saying. We're all here because we're greedy. We heard about this thing, awakening, and we think, okay, I'll do this. It's like so hard. You know, not sleeping in our own beds and sitting still for a long time, not moving. It's really hard. The first time I heard this story, I just totally identified with Ming. You know, yeah, me too. But I would have given up way before he did, I think. But I didn't. Actually, I didn't. Yeah. What am I saying? I kept going, you know, how many decades? Yeah. And then that moment when he tries to lift the robe and the bowl, may we all have that impossible moment. The thing I came for is not what I'm getting. Whoa. So powerful, isn't it?
Thanks. Will.
In the talk, I found myself, it took me a while to see what was happening, but I am so convinced and have been so long promising myself and the world that I would become better, you know, that I have this lack, that it's a funny thing that I suddenly think, well, if I let go of that lack and say, well, you know, actually, I know I have all these shortcomings. That's the way it is. Too bad. It's very hard for me to let go of that, right? And because I feel such a strong sense that I promised myself and everyone that I would get better, you know? And so the robe I can't lift is this, like, I know I can get better. I know I can. I'm not going to say it's okay because it's not okay.
Well, and Will, I so appreciate you voicing that conviction, because I think it's not just you, right? A lot of smiles and nodding heads. The certainty, the faith we have is just astonishing in our lack.
Yeah.
And you know, looking into this and seeing how attached we are to it. You know, you'd think, oh, yeah, I see it. I'm just going to let that go. That's a real painful thing. No, no, this is me.
Yeah.
Right? This is me. And so I'm just so happy at your ongoing failure. Right? You're just acing that. And I do believe that in some ways failure is the only way in. A failure of whatever strategy we've been doing to be good enough. If I'm smart enough, if I work hard enough, if I'm nice enough, you know. And so this koan is a koan of Ming's failure, mm-hmm. right? And I really appreciate you sharing your failure.
And I just add, Will, that it's not even, I've got all these shortcomings, well, so what? It's, I've got all these shortcomings, thank God. Mm-hmm. Because these are your Dharma gates. Mm-hmm. As some wise teachers told me once, you know, our limp is our strength. You know, our trash is our treasure.
Yeah, so this sense of lack is the treasure, just like mm-hmm. the sense of greed mm-hmm. is the treasure. There's nothing, we want to put stuff in the bad bucket,
yeah.
right? Mm-hmm. Don't think good, don't think mm-hmm. evil. We might mm-hmm. say, don't think have not. Uh-huh. It's like, okay, I'm going to own this thing. You know, and you probably know lots of people who say, yeah, you know, I came to this place where, yeah, so I lack, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Do you believe those people?
No, they're just, it doesn't work for me.
Right, yeah, no, it doesn't yeah. work for anybody. Those people don't do what Ming did, and they don't do what the Buddha did. They don't sit under the Bo tree for all those hours, or however long it was, being assailed by these things. And David pointing out that, the Buddha became friends with Mara. You know, in a way, our greed, our sense of lack, they're Dharma gates, as Alan was just saying. They are the entry points, and they are our dearest treasure friends. You know, and if we keep pushing them away, they keep coming back, right? Don't they? And what if we just said, "All right, okay, there you go, thank you." You know, just hugging them, saying, "Thank the lack, the lack, the lack, your buddy." How amazing! But this is so counterintuitive. Also,
yeah.
It is
yeah.
not logical.
Right? Like,
none of this is.
Yeah. So what you get, the thing I've been trying to get, is actually my lack, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Whoa.
So quit bragging.
Or something like
that. Yeah. Or something like that. Yeah.
Right.
Thanks, Will.
Thank you.
Yeah. This keeps sounding to me, this thing that everything is already there, you just don't see it, that the seeing of it sounds like grace, which was the bane of my existence as a Cyprian Christian, because mm-hmm. I felt I didn't have it because I didn't believe in Jesus and everyone around me did. You still come down to, we're waiting for this moment, whether you see all these different parts in the lack, you're still waiting for this moment, and it shows up or it doesn't for long periods of time. And that's, seems unfair.
well, see, I think what you're pointing out, and I keep thinking this throughout the Dharma talk and this Dharma dialogue, the feeling of the greed, the feeling of the lack, the feeling of the waiting, it hurts. It's actually quite painful to face it. It's not just, oh, la, 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 come here, be my buddy.
Yeah.
That sounds too easy, and it's not what Will was saying. Oh, I'm fine. Yeah, whatever. I know. It's all already here. It's like, ouch, oh, it's so painful. And, you know, in Sesshin we get to have some physical pain on top of it, and also in aging we get to have some physical pain. But the honoring of how hard this is not like Christian grace, because there's nobody up there to give it to you, right? No, but I can see what you're saying, because the fact that it's already here, but we don't feel it, hurts so bad. It just, oh, and everybody, I mean, look around, just have to look around the Sangha here, but also look around the world. The world is just full of this pain. This is dukkha, right? This was the first noble truth. The first noble truth of the Buddha wasn't, yeah, it's hard, but you know, everything's fine. He didn't say that. He never said that. He said, it hurts. It hurts. And this is what we begin with. And the transformation of dukkha is not our task. It's the entering it and feeling it fully. Just like, I love Monk Ming. I just feel him. I mean, can you imagine? You just chased up this mountain, and you're sweaty and you're exhausted. You probably have a good sense of yourself as some, you know, athlete. I don't know, he was a general. And then you get to, and here, take it. And he can't lift it. I feel that way so often, and I'm not going to mind read you, but I bet a bunch of us do. Oh, through our own efforts, nothing happens. And yet, here we are.
And I,
yeah.
Yeah, it caught us all here. I think of William Blake's saying that you can't storm the gates of heaven. There's some way we want to do this. Just tell me, lay out the path and I'll get there. And that's what I was saying about this. We cannot do this. You know, it's not like if I squint hard enough, I can make it happen. So we're kind of helpless here. We're stuck. We're stuck where we are, and we think that's the problem. And I think what we're saying is that's not the problem. This is the entry point, the place where we're stuck, which it is oftentimes the place we really, really, really do not want to be. Kind of the last place in the world we want to be. And the richness and the possibility of each moment in that. Yeah. Alan.
I just couldn't help, because you mentioned grace, I couldn't help thinking of the original face versus original sin. and you know, because of original sin in the Christian tradition, as Melissa said, we need something from outside. We need grace abounding to the cheapest of sinners, you know, grace from God. Very important that we can't that we can't do it on our own. But with the original face, our brokenness is not a problem because it's part of this huge field of things that are broken and not broken, and it's all been there from the beginning. There's no fall myth in Buddhism. There's no original sin, and then, you know, accepting that it comes back to what we were talking with Will about, just accepting that it's okay to be broken. That's as a great singer says, that's how the light gets in.
Thanks. Brad. Yeah, the guy behind Brad.
I'm thinking, what if Ming and the whole community was right, and that the fifth patriarch waited too long and made a senile choice? What if the wrong person was elected president? And so what that means to me is, there's something floating around about navel gazing, like when the time of action is at hand, do we just sit with ourselves, with our protest, with our path? I mean, they ran after him. It turned out that Huineng was the real deal, but it might not have been, and so that vigorous action seems also important. So I'm not sure, but it's something about Zen sort of the acceptance canceling the important action or something like that. I'm not quite sure.
So Brad, what do you know something about this? What do you know about action?
Well, it's that sitting nullifies action. That's not at all true, right? That's mm-hmm. the main thing.
Yeah, so what is the relationship to sitting and action that you know to be true?
Well, that it's kind of the same, I guess. Mm-hmm. Or the more I practice, the more it's the same thing. Yeah.
I think so. We do, you know, we have these dualities, good and evil, sitting and action. And so you're creating this sort of story you don't really believe. And in these koans, if you work in the koan curriculum, you will be deliberately misled sometimes to believe what some teacher says when the only way through is to know what you know. So you know something about sitting and you know that it's not the opposite of action. Maybe the opposite, maybe this clarity of purpose and clear seeing allows us to take strong action. Right ancestor, wrong ancestor, right transmission, wrong transmission, is really kind of meaningless talk in some way, because what has happened has happened, and we have to trust when it's time for us to do something, and to do it. Yeah.
And many of you probably know this story, a different koan, where somebody gives the wrong answer to his students and is turned into a fox for how many lifetimes? 500 lives as a fox, right? And then, he has this awakening with the teacher and blah, blah, blah. But then later, a student comes up to the teacher and says, but what if he'd given the right answer? This is exactly the kind of question you're asking mm-hmm. right now. What if it had been right? Mm-hmm. That's an important koan point in that koan, because it stirs up the very things that you're wondering about. And the reality of the legend that we're telling here, I love that phrase, I just made it up, the reality of the legend, is that most people stayed with Shen Shu. You know, Hungren died, and Shen Shu, the guy who lost the poetry contest, became the teacher and had Dharma heirs and, you know, whole school, right? So, and Hui Neng had to justify himself, or somebody justified it in this text that somebody made up about him. So we've got the duality right there. They're both valid. They're both... it's watching the but. It's the and. Right? So you go where you go, and you know, as David pointed out, that action and practice are the same.
And Brad, you might recall that in that koan, when the senior student says, what if he'd answer right every time, the teacher says, come on up closer.
Right up. Yeah, just come here.
But stay where you are. I think we have time for another question. The last one.
I was really struck by Wei Nong. So here's Ming. He's like, he's, you know, big, and he's right in front of him, and he's like, you know, I'm taking that because you're all like a nobody. And Wei Nong is like, I'll take it. Mm-hmm. Like, he doesn't get defensive or like say, oh, the fifth patriarch gave it to me because I'm, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. You know, he just like, he was like, yeah, you know, you want it or you're here, just mm-hmm. take it. I don't know, there was something mm-hmm. very beautiful in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful to notice that, right? This possibility. So we have these ranks. So maybe you're a Tenzo, or maybe you're a teacher or a Tanto, and we can defend our rank. Well, no, I've been practicing for 10 years. You can't say that to me. Whatever. How to give it away. right, the invitation for all of us to give away whatever whatever rank you think you have, or whatever rank you're sure you don't have, give that away too, right? This real generosity that then allows the Dharma to flower, right? The sixth, you know, Huineng didn't make anything happen. He kind of gave it all away.
Yeah. And you know, that when we work with koans, this loops back to Laura's original point. We're encouraged to identify with the characters. And we can notice who we are over the years, especially those of us who've been practicing for a while. I've heard this koan many times. You know, I always used to identify with Ming, and then I started identifying with Huineng. And then there's the horde that goes up the mountain. You know, they're just to and you're doing that. You are Huineng, releasing. And Laura is Ming, racing up the mountain and giving everything she has. And we want to be flexible enough so that we don't cling to a narrow identity, but can become everyone, all of us, doing our best to realize the great way.
And we're all sometimes Shenshu polishing that mirror.
Yeah.
Yes. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, let's restore the Zendo, polish the mirror, let go of the mirror, whatever.